From the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, this is The Steady Stater, a podcast dedicated to discussing limits to growth in the steady state economy.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Brian Check, and our guest today is Sandy Irvin, coming to us from the English city of Newcastle. Sandy is a great example of what we might call an independent sustainability operator. He doesn't have a new book, he's not a YouTube star, and he's not running for office. But if you run in sustainability circles, you will often run across his name and his wide-ranging work, and it's good stuff. Sandy has written and taught extensively on limits to growth. For some years, Sandy served as associate editor at The Ecologist. He established and co-edited the magazine Real World, a green politics publication. He writes now regularly for none other than Sandy Irvin's Green Blog. And Sandy helped organize the Green Party of England and Wales. We'll come back to the relevance of that in a few minutes. Sandy Irvin, welcome to the Steady Stater.
Oh, thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Sandy, I have to ask, any relation to the famous mountaineer who disappeared on Mount Everest?
I don't think so. If you type in the name on Google, he appears thousands of times, I admit.
Yes. Well, I mention your namesake because for listeners who do Google you up, they'll want to apply an adjective.
Yes.
Green, for example. And then they're going to find a remarkable collection of writings, presentations, and news clips. Well, you got in touch with us here at CASI a short time back regarding your critique of the so-called Global Alliance for a Green New Deal. The Global Alliance appears to be a coalition of lawmakers from about 20 countries where these Green New Deal concepts have become more or less prominent. In particular, you were writing to us about supergrids. What are supergrids and what are the issues you see with them?
Well, can I tell you when I first came across the idea? It was in a public lecture at the local university, and there was a diagram projected onto the big screen, and it showed a network of grids bringing electricity all the way to Britain from the heart of Libya, where there were going to be gigantic solar power stations. But I suddenly thought, who's in charge of Libya? Well, it was Colonel Gaddafi. And I thought, we're only switching one kind of dependency for another. So how can that really be progress to a genuinely resilient, sustainable society? You know, that's on top of all the construction costs of building the grid, the platforms, the pylons, the wires, the management stations, all the complex operations needed to balance supply and demand. I think it's trying to put off the day when we will have to make that transition that I think we agree about, that we've got to abandon the whole project of economic growth. It's trying to keep a failing show on the road.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that Global Alliance Declaration includes some material about new measures of progress rather than quote-unquote growth at any cost. And you, in your critique, you define these as weasel words, and we tend to agree with that. But why do you think so many of these advocates for a new economy come so close to saying the truth about limits to growth, saying it clearly that there's a limit to growth and we need degrowth toward a steady state economy, but then they shy away right at the last minute? What's happening there?
I think the problem is public perceptions. We've become addicted to growth. Almost every night on the TV news, we hear reports which imply growth good, no growth bad, more growth even better, faster growth better still. You know, it's burned its way deep into the mindset of millions of people. And some people draw the conclusion that we've got to pull back a little bit. We've got to pull punches. But really, I think the Green Party here had a slogan about speaking truth to power. I think we've got to spell out the facts of life, basically. Yes, we've got to pitch it carefully, but at the heart of our messaging has got to be the core truth about overshoot, about limits, about the need to slim down. We obviously talk about slimming down in health terms sometimes, and it'll be good for some individuals. Well, it'll be good for society as well.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with the evening news and the mass media in general. It's sort of like, run, Dick, run, grow economy, grow. It's so simplistic and so shallow. But you mentioned the Green Party, and I mentioned that in the intro as well. One thing that I want to make sure listeners are aware of is that the party that you helped to organize, the Green Party of England and Wales, that was one of the first political parties in the world to have the steady state economy as a plank in its platform.
That's true, but really there have been big changes since I first joined the party in roughly 1980. Then it was called the Ecology Party. And I think there's a bit of a clue in the name that it chose, what its raison d'etre was, what its identity was. It changed its name to the Green Party, partly to jump on the bandwagon, if I'm going to be truthful, the bandwagon of the successors of Die Grünen in Germany. But in the subsequent years, there's been what I would call a degreening, a marginalising of that core mission, of those core ideas, the core vision. And they've been shoved to the edges and supplanted by other ideas, and I would argue, poorer ideas.
I'm so disappointed to hear that. I had detected bits and pieces of that because I did notice, for example, the document that you produced recently. It's called The Green Party, Population and Climate Breakdown.
Yes.
And you did raise some concerns about some of these changes proposed. In fact, there's a motion evidently that seeks to delete a chapter on population from the party's core document. I guess I should just come right out and ask you, is the steady state economy still even in the platform?
It's not explicitly there. I think it's fair to distinguish between rank and file members, many of whom would recognise, for example, that we've got population problems, and the kind of people who've become predominant in leading circles. I mean, political parties tend to be broad churches. So I don't want to mislead you. I think there's a lot of good people in the Green Party here, and a lot of them are receptive to the ideas of steady state economics. I mean, I try to push people like Herman Daly, your book, for example, and I know people read them, but they tend to be activists at a local level. I think a lot of the problems are with the central party, and I detect similar problems across in the United States and indeed in Canada.
Oh, that's for sure. Well, in the USA, green politics are far from what's been achieved in Europe. Steady staters, I think we tend to look with some envy at the success of the green parties in Europe. But I guess if they're changing such that the plain stated facts about limits to growth and the need for a steady state economy is no longer part of that green deal, well, I don't know. And I don't know where that leaves us with green parties around the world.
I think a lot of the people you would first of all target with the steady state message are going to be in and around green parties. But let's not overlook new movements such as Extinction Rebellion. There's a potential audience there. I think, to be blunt, we've got to look at these organisations, these movements, as potential audiences in which to fight for the steady state idea.
Well, that's true. I think there are a lot of environmental factions and movements out there that are sort of like steady staters without being aware of it.
Well, that's right, yes. Or it's I think it's implied by what they want. Let's put it like that. They're not going to get what they want without a conscious drive to move from a growth economy to a steady state economy. I mean, I'll give you perhaps the best example. You know, there's a great deal of concern about the decimation of wildlife. But that's not going to stop unless you stop an expanding economy, because that will consume more and more land, more and more resources, and there'll be less and less left over for wildlife. So, you know, there's a logic there, and the challenge is to try and get people to grasp that logic.
Well, I guess that relates back to a suggestion you made somewhere, that in these various Green New Deals, that are the cumulative Green New Deal global movement, there may actually be too much focus on the global heating problem, because it tends to eclipse our consideration of the broader and or the underlying and overarching ecological overshoot issues.
The discourse here is just reduced to carbon emissions, even other problem emissions such as methane and nitrous oxide tend to be neglected. The focus is a very one-dimensional one on just carbon emissions. And yet there are many things that could cripple society. The elimination of insect species, for example, will be devastating. The knock-on effects of that could be catastrophic. If you go back in history, soil erosion has done for more civilizations than any other factor in ecological terms. You know, we ignore all these other issues about soil, about water, about wildlife, about invasive species, about chemicalization, plastification. Brian, I could go on, but you know all this. It's a cocktail of problems. And what unites them is that they are symptoms.
Mm-hmm. We just had Dave Goulson on the show last week, and even as an ecologist, that was a real eye-opener to me, because I'd never really taken a deep dive into entomological ecology. And Dave Goulson really described blow by blow where and why and how insects are crashing, and the profound implications of that for our global ecosystems and future of our economies as well.
Well, you wouldn't knock away the foundations of your house, would you? Well, I hope you wouldn't, but that's what, in effect, we're doing. I think one of the problems is that we tend to be captivated by more charismatic species. One of the best things I ever saw in my life was out on the Pacific watching whales. Amazing experience. And you focus on that, but not on the tiny little creatures. But just because they're small doesn't mean they're critically important.
Right, yeah, like the krill.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I'm going to have to take a time out here. We need to take a short non-commercial break with James Lamont. Take it away, James.
Hello, listeners. We hope you're enjoying our conversation with Sandy Irvin. As Brian mentioned, Sandy has a great blog, and if you enjoy reading about these issues as much as listening, you should also take a look at the Cassie blog, The Steady State Herald. Each Thursday, a rotating cast of contributors from Cassie's staff and volunteers provides an in-depth look at an issue, concept, or perspective in the world of steady-state economics. Recently, we've made posts on the Genuine Progress Indicator Act introduced in Congress, our proposed legislation to ban flying, ridiculous rockets, and housing policy. You can catch up and subscribe at steadystate.org underneath the Follow tab, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the show, where our guest is Sandy Irvin. And we just heard from James Lamont, fellow Englishman, actually, of yours, Sandy. And he was telling me that recently there were wild celebrations in Newcastle, where you are, because the local soccer club, Newcastle United, was bought by the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund. So this makes them the richest soccer club in the world, thanks to all that Saudi oil money. And it also seems that the fans are starting to make a connection between a successful competition and the need for ever-expanding and deeper economic pockets. So arguably, there may be a post-growth case to be made on a cultural level. Do you think there's much hope for that?
The problem is that for many people, football is the highlight of their week, which is a rather sad comment on people's everyday lives and particularly their working lives, that they look forward to when Saturday comes. And they invest so much in this enthusiasm that they're prepared to welcome success by any means, even if this means very tainted money. And what we're also seeing is that some of the people who've bought the club, I'm thinking of two brothers, also now own a big chunk of Newcastle city centre. So the fate of the city centre is in the hands of just two people, which on democratic grounds alone can't be right, nor is it right that they're just pushing for more super office blocks, more super shops, you know, more of what we've got already. But I don't know. I think one thing hits the fans is that the cost of supporting teams is also going up and up and up. It costs a lot of money to be a fan because a lot of these clubs, I'm now thinking of Manchester United, for example, were bought by people who bought the club by borrowing money, and they used the club to pay off those debts. And so they've got to get some money from somewhere, and that means squeezing the fans.
The COP26 UN Climate Summit starts there in a couple weeks, and it's hard not to get swept up in all the talk about how this COP summit has to go perfectly, unlike the last 25 of them. Not to get too cynical, but Sandy, what would be your advice for people after this summit fails to deliver the solutions, the steady state solutions that we really need?
My advice would be not to build up your hopes in the first place, because sad to say, I think any exaggerated hopes are going to be cruelly dashed. I was just looking today at the resurgence of coal burning, for example, or just to take one in my region, the scale of peatland burning that's been uncovered. You know, these are all things that should be stopping, and yet the very people who are promising to save the planet are also pushing ahead with the very things that will destroy the planet. So much as I would love it to be a success, I think even if you look at the pledges that have been made so far, and they only deal in carbon emissions, but if you look at those pledges, they're not enough. So even if it was a success in its own terms, it's not enough to stop continued global overheating. And I think that's what we've got to call it. We really must stop talking about climate change.
I totally agree. It's global heating and it's global humidifying that you can really feel more and more as well. You made a video recently with the hashtag Older and Greener, and it was about the risks that global heating pose to older generations, and also about the skills that older people can bring to the table when it comes to finding solutions. There was a study a few weeks ago from King's College London and New Scientist about attitudes to environmental collapse, which found, contrary to popular belief, that older generations, at least in the UK, care just as much about these challenges as younger generations. However, they were also found to be the group most likely to state that economic growth should take precedence. What's the cognitive dissonance there?
Well, old people, as in all generations, come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. You know, I'm loath to generalize, but here goes. I think old people have been sort of stigmatized and treated as reactionary and passive and what have you. But there's another report came out from the Policy Institute that found that older citizens were the group most likely to boycott products or companies on ethical grounds, you know, fair trade, sustainable trade, whatever you want to call it. An interesting statistic here that you might have read about, the Extinction Rebellion protests, road blocking and things like that. I think 23% of all those arrested by the police were over 55. I mean, you might have an image in your head of young protesters, But clearly, there are big contingents of older people there. And in my experience, in terms of single issue campaigns, you've always had a strong presence of older people, partly because they've got the time, partly because they can offer knowledge and valuable experience. Partly, they can see how things have been slip sliding away over the years because they've been around for a longer time and they can see the differences happening. That said, you know, I'm a child of the boom years. And, you know, to some extent, economic growth in the 1950s did deliver some goods. You know, we started off in a house that was condemned as a slum. And then my parents were moved into, to be fair, a decent council house. There was the National Health Service. I went to a state school. We always had good food on the table. But my parents were factory workers, but we lived quite well. And I think that can colour your view of things, you know, that, you know, we did witness some progress. You know, I can remember seeing kids with polio, for example. I can remember having to use an outdoor toilet. Some things do improve. The tragedy is that people begin then conclude that can go on forever. They don't appreciate that economic growth can stop delivering good things and start delivering more and more bad things. And that's the difficulty. I think there's another difficulty is that I think a lot of older people tend to be more attached to their motor cars than other people for obvious mobility reasons. And they become a reservoir of opposition to some of the measures that we need. For example, there's a proposal for a big pedestrianisation scheme in the middle of Newcastle. And the most vocal opposition is coming from some older people, not me, but some other older people.
That resonates with me. I used to ride my bike to work for about 20 years, well, maybe 30 years if you count grad school and so on. And I have a very hard time doing that now because of the knees, which wear out. And now I'm stuck driving the Prius, but at least I have the GDP bad license plate on her.
I think we've got to offer something that helps people make the transition. If I could just stick with that example of pedestrianisation. If you look in Ljubljana in Slovenia, they've gone down that road. In many ways, it's the greenest city in Europe. But what they did at the same time is provide the equivalent of those electric golf carts that you see on golf courses and at airports to take people around, particularly older people, for free around the city centre. So in other words, if you've got mobility issues, an alternative has been provided for you. And I think that can overcome some of the resistance if we try and have a comprehensive package of measures that does include some sweeteners, as well as the perhaps not welcome medicine itself.
Mm-hmm, good point. Well, and finally, I know you've taken a special interest in the Green New Deal. We've talked about it, but can you tell us a little more about the international structure, infrastructure of the Green, you know, the political infrastructure of this Green New Deal that's developed and perhaps become co-opted to some degree? That would be something we might suspect, because we've seen that happen time and again when it comes to strong sustainability getting weaker. And what's going on with the Green New Deal internationally, Sandy?
Well, if you go to their website, you'll see pictures of what you might call radical politicians from various countries. And you can probably guess who they are in the United States. I'm not too sure whether they've been co-opted. I think they've bought into a certain way of looking at the world. It's one that bashes the bankers, for example, the finance sector. No problems there, don't get me wrong. But we face a bigger problem. It's the scale of the economy, not just one malignant part of that economy. It's a worldview that blames everything on a few rich people, what was called the 1% by the Occupy movement. It rather implies that the other 99% are just innocent victims of some sort. But it ignores reality. It's a kind of old-fashioned view of what used to be called, and I'm using the word that was used decades ago, that there were backward countries. But some of those countries now have changed radically. I mean, China's got some of the biggest shopping malls in the world. It's the biggest market for gas-guzzling SUVs. You know, there's something that is sometimes called the new global middle class. You know, it's people across Africa and Latin America, Asia, who are no longer those poor people and low-consuming people. They've moved up a bracket. So it's not good enough. It's easy, though, but it's not good enough just to say it's the super rich, or it's just a few fat cats, or just to blame big corporations, as if there wasn't some demand out there from the public for the products being made by these big corporations. But you've got to face the fact that these firms make what they do is because there's enough people out there who like buying them. Nobody's forced into a McDonald's. Nobody has to buy fashionable clothes over and over again. I mean, there is a crisis of culture. It's not just something you can blame on a few bad apples, but it's easier to do that, isn't it? It's a kind of sort of populism on the left, just to sort of absolve the people and ignore issues in popular lifestyles, but just direct your fire on greedy fat cats and people like that. And don't get me wrong, yes, they should be held to account, and they are certainly part of the problem, but there's more to the problem than just a few greedy fat cats.
Well, you made some really good points there, and it's true that maybe there's not a whole lot of co-opting of the Green New Deal necessary when you're right, they kind of started out from the green growth oxymoron in a lot of cases. So
yes, I mean, even that those two words, endless growth, buried in there is, well, perhaps we can just squeeze out some clean growth or whatever you want to, some smart growth or whatever jargon you want to use. It's just not saying, look, we're in a state of overshoot. Collectively, we are consuming too much. That's the real nub of the problem.
Well, Sandy, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show today. I mean, I know a lot of the subject matter isn't the cheeriest, but we at least like to talk with smart people and get some fresh perspectives and learn more about what's going on out there in the world. So I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks so much for spending the time with us today.
Well, thanks for the invitation, and I've really enjoyed it too. Thanks.
Well, folks, that about wraps her up. We've been talking with Sandy Irvin, an outstanding example of an independent sustainability operator. Like many other such operators, Sandy's largely retired from the paid work of his earlier career. Rather than fishing or playing cards full-time, he's brought his wealth of experience to bear in a determined effort to help save the planet. I hope a lot of retirees follow suit. I'm Brian Check, and you've been listening to the Steady Stater podcast. See you next time.